This is The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joseph Cohen from the City University of New York. Today, criticizing Lana Del Rey. Our guest is Rachel Skaggs from The Ohio State University. Rachel recently published in Social Psychology Quarterly, Harmonizing Small Group Cohesion and Status in Creative Collaborations, How Songwriters Facilitate and Manipulate the Co-Writing Process. My co-hosts for this episode are Leslie Hinkson from Georgetown University and Gabriel Rossman from UCLA. This episode was recorded on September 10th, 2019. So academia forces us to put ourselves out there, you know, and when you put yourself out there, you get negative reactions, right? With writing, it's reviews, critical commentary. In the classroom, we have the student evaluations. On social media, you can get blowback for the things you say. And when you create and put things out there, it's just part of the business, getting negative feedback. And of course, it's not exclusive to academia. Recently, there's been a stir in the music world related to a negative review of Lana Del Rey's new album, which I really liked. So thank you for that recommendation. And for those of you who don't know, she is an American pop musician. She's probably best known for her 2012 song, Summertime Sadness. And she recently released a new album titled Norman Effing Rockwell. This is where I would cue Gabriel in to swear and give us the explicit rating for this episode.
Yeah.
Rachel, do you want to give the backstory?
Let it happen organically. You can't force it.
All right.
Yeah, sure. So on Twitter this past week, or maybe it's been a while now, but recently on Twitter, Ann Powers, who's a music critic for NPR, wrote a pretty long feature on Lana Del Rey's new album. And I thought it was quite nuanced. It was overall, I think the tenor was positive, but Lana did not think so and retweeted the review and said, basically, you don't know what you're talking about. You're wrong. And you don't get this, basically. And then following that, all of her fans came to Lana's defense and really kind of flooded Twitter with their responses saying how Anne doesn't understand and she is not a real fan.
Yeah. So it was overall the record got really good reviews, right? It got a terrific review on the LA from the LA Times, got like an 87% score on Metacritic.
Got a really good review from Pitchfork.
Mm-hmm. From Pitch, I won't even pretend to know what that is. And then what happened was, oh, I have the quote here. So she writes to Ann Powers, who's a well-known music critic. She writes, here's a little side note on your piece. I don't even relate to one observation you made about the music. There's nothing uncooked about me. To write about me is nothing like it is to be with me. I've never had a persona. I've never needed one. I never will. And, you know, the Times noted that I read the review and it was overall quite nuanced. It was quite a good review. But at times, I guess there were comments like, that the music had aspects of neediness or disempoweredness. I think she was implicitly criticized for not promoting female empowerment in her lyrics and things like that. So what's your take on this one?
My take is I don't want to hear it because I love the album and I don't want to ruin it with this petty squabble. So I'm just going to spend the rest of this 20-minute segment going la, 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 not listening. At least I can cut it out later.
Well, I think it's a good thing, right, that so Ann Powers as a music critic really takes women seriously. That's kind of her position on it, is that she thinks that women haven't been taken seriously for their musical contributions. And I think that by giving a nuanced and, you know, somewhat critical, but also positive review, that that's actually engaging with the music and taking it seriously.
And my take on it is, you know, as an artist, I mean, I assume that most artists create a thing, right? And then you release it out into the world and people who consume it are allowed to interpret it the way that they want to. And, you know, that's just your role as artist. And now you may or may not have a take on your work that you want everyone to have. But I mean, I think that most artists would agree, well, yeah, I created a thing and this is an interactive process. And I kind of felt as though Lana Del Rey's pushback against Powers actually in many ways says, okay, the consumer of my artwork doesn't have the power and power to interpret it the way that they interpret it. And so in some ways that reaction was disappointing to me.
Now, so I did not read the review. I didn't read any of the criticism of it, because like I said, I just want to be able to like the album. But based on Rachel's synopsis of it, I'm guessing that part of it may be kind of a defensiveness, and that earlier she was attacked for Artifice, like in with her first album. And the idea that she doesn't have a persona is ridiculous. I mean, it doesn't say Lana Del Rey on her birth certificate. And she, you know, she very much has a pretty elaborate artistic persona. But it's something that early on, like in her first album, there were a bunch of pylons of Born to Die, that it was, you know, like Artifice and a little bit of Svengali thing and the idea that somebody crafted it for her and everything like that. So I think it may be, my guess would be that it's less her arguing with Powers and more her arguing with somebody, what Power said that reminded her of what somebody else said, that, you know, in the same way that like your spouse might get in a fight with you about nothing, and really it's because you just reminded them, you innocently reminded them of something they saw at work, you know?
Like a sore spot, right? Like they just to really kind of turn the knife a little bit, but the knife isn't there, right?
Or the knife was there a few hours ago, but you weren't the one holding it.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, it's there's a difference between reacting in real time and then having the time to craft something that you write on Twitter, right? And then not remove it. So
Twitter's not really a crafted type of medium, though.
I wouldn't know.
Well, you know what, though, the idea that she has a persona is something, I mean, maybe you guys can comment on it. You're better versed in the sociology of culture than I am, but it doesn't that sort of poke at this notion of authenticity in music? And, you know, isn't there a need when you're an artist to emote authenticity or transmit authenticity, and to imply that there's a persona is to, you know, somewhat sully the image or the magic of
it? I think it depends, right? I think it depends. I think that if you are casting yourself as this like singer-songwriter, right, you know, I think that's a sort of like authenticity is this thing. But I mean, there are plenty of artists out there who admit to have readily to having personas. I mean, think about Beyonce, right? I mean, she's like, yeah, you know, I'm Sasha Fierce when I'm out there on stage, for example. And her fans love her for that.
Regardless of authenticity, everyone has a personal brand, right? If you're putting yourself out there as an artist, you're selling a brand. So regardless of if it's real or not, if it's a persona or some sort of unfiltered reality, there is a brand there, and you have to kind of match up the brand with the art, right?
But the exposition of some persona can be brand consistent, right? Like for Beyonce to say, oh, I'm not like this Tiger when I go out there, I'm really, you know, somebody else. She can still do it. It's still like brand consistent. This type of thing, calling Lana Del Rey, you know, calling her sort of professional image or persona is like pointing out that Kid Rock is really like a rich kid from Georgia and not some, you know, working
class
guy from Michigan. He's rich.
Yeah.
And there's a difference between, you know, sort of pulling back the curtain on one persona versus another.
I also wondered how much of it may have been that this might be this playing out of a kind of generational squabble, right? I don't recall how old the critic is, but she is older than Lana Del Rey is. And, you know, my daughters love Lana Del Rey. I'm kind of like, eh, you know, I mean, and that might be a generational thing. And so I'm wondering how much of Powers' interpretation of Lana Del Rey and then Lana Del Rey's interpretation of Powers' critique, right, is a sign of this sort of generational divide. And, you know, Powers wanting her to be like, oh, come on, be more of a feminist. And Lana Del Rey just saying, hey, I'm singing songs about my life.
Well, and it's ironic that you're talking about generation, because her whole artistic persona is basically putting herself in the position of somebody from roughly the 1910 birth cohort.
But that is interesting too, thinking about kind of who reads music criticism, because I think in Ann Powers, she's very well established. I think that she's in charge of music at NPR. That's her bit. She's very well established in the field. And I think that people in Lana Del Rey's kind of generational group of fans, they might not be used to reading music criticism. I think that the older generations maybe grew up with that more so than the kind of amateur critiques or kind of takes that people have on social media, which her fans might be more familiar with. And a lot of them did comment, who is this Ann Powers? Who is she? I've never heard of her. Right. So maybe they're not familiar with the genre.
But Powers has apparently gotten into this type of friction before. There was a really interesting piece that she had in the LA Times about blowback that she got for criticizing Tina Turner and the Jonas Brothers. Like, she's gotten into these messes before. And she wrote a really interesting piece. Like, when does an artist become untouchable? Is there a point at which criticizing someone's work results in so much blowback that you don't even want to get involved with it? You know, maybe the fans personalize the criticism, or they feel the need to defend their, you know, their group head or whatever. I thought that was kind of an interesting topic in and of itself, right?
Oh, no, for sure. Because like the next thing that happens is that then like someone like posts something on Twitter, like using a Sharpie, erasing certain words from the critique and having it seem like it's actual fact, and then getting other people, you know, under their employ or under or who owes them a favor to come back and say, yes, that was actual truth.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. It's something that I think happens in our line of work too. Like, there's a danger when you publish critical work. I remember the blowback we got for the False Notions of Objectivity episode we did, right? Because people take that as a personal attack when you sort of hang your hat on a person or a movement or something.
I don't even remember that. I remember us doing that conversation, but I don't remember any blowback, and I kind of don't care.
Oh, I got blowback. I wouldn't expect you to.
Yeah.
But we also typically get our critiques in a blinded fashion, and other people don't have to see those critiques, right? Like,
right.
Okay, so that's an interesting point, right? Because people can be pretty blunt in peer reviews for journals, but there's a convention that people are much less blunt in reviewing books.
Mm.
And I feel like one of my distinctive things as a sociologist is I've actually written negative book reviews.
Hmm.
Whereas, you know, you go through contemporary sociology and it's just a big, like, you feel like everybody took Molly before they started typing.
But it does reflect back on you, right? Like, yeah. I was the book review editor for a journal. And I mean, I think that that's something that people take into account when they accept or reject to even do the book review, right? Like, can I give this a positive review?
Yeah.
Right. But what about this whole sense of, like, is there an oversensitivity aspect to all of this? Because ultimately all it does is it produces less interesting book reviews. And I'll admit, like, I've written some pretty tepid book reviews of stuff that I didn't care for, but didn't bother to take on.
But do you think it's a career stage thing? Like, would people, if it's your first book and you know that this is going to be important for them going up for tenure, maybe you would be less critical. And then also on the flip side, someone who's more established, there's more to kind of pick at, more critique that you could give them in a kind of holistic way about how their scholarship fits into some sort of trajectory.
I mean, I think that's been the norm. The way that I was socialized into the discipline and into academia was just that way. Now, you don't have to totally conform to that norm, but there was, I mean, I was trained with the understanding that, yeah, you don't want to ruin someone's prospects for tenure, but, you know, once they get tenured, you know, you can take the gloves off.
I think Leslie's right that in a weird way, like, you might expect that the reason you go easy on non-blinded book reviews, well, actually, I kind of agree and I kind of don't. Okay, so you might expect the reason you're very nice in book reviews, but not nice in journal reviews is because, you know, it could blow back on you. And then you're saying, like, well, but there's this whole idea of, like, are you going to do that to somebody where it could be a critical phase in their career or something like that? But then why aren't we nice in journal reviews? I mean, part of it could be because you don't know that it was an assistant professor or an ABD or whatever who wrote the journal article. But even if you suspect it, and any editor will tell you that they'll get, like, the private comment to the editor saying, you know, I'm not mad at this author. I'm mad at their advisor for letting them send it out. And then they tell their friends, like, oh, actually, that was from a senior scholar who's, like, But I think it's a weird kind of thing of, like, we do have this etiquette of, like, you don't want to perform your scholarly function of screening someone out from a permanent position who's totally incompetent, you know, but we do it in journal review because it's blinded. I think there really is something to it being blinded.
This reminds me of Lipa Chung's work. So she has the book coming out about literary book reviews and argues about them being a genre unto themselves, which the book review also is for us, right? Like, that's a line on a CV that's different from just, I'm a you know, ad hoc review or for a journal. So not only is it the function of reflecting something about that scholar's career, but it also says something about you. So not just are you cutting them down, but do you come across as collegial or contributing to the discipline in a positive or a negative way?
Exactly. The book review is a reflection of you, right? And there are ways when even when you don't like the book, right, you don't like the argument, there are ways that you can present a critique that doesn't crush a person's career in the early stage, right? And so, you know, the way we would do during, you know, that what we do during seminars, right? Like, this is very interesting, right? Which is just an empty word, right? But it's not a mean word. And, you know, this is what your argument is. You know, what I really liked was you always start with what you really like. And then you say, well, but I had some questions, right? And I would urge you, even though the book is already published and there's nothing else you can do about it, I would urge you to think about X, Y, and Z. I mean, that's a way for you to sort of present yourself as, you know what, people, right? I know my stuff, right? But I'm also not a dick. So
I think thinking about the kind of case that we're coming from, so this Lana Del Rey thing, it also made me think of something earlier this summer where an artist tweeted out something and then the fans jumped on the bandwagon, but it had a positive effect. So Taylor Swift, when Big Machine, her record label was sold, and there was this kind of discomfort or unhappiness and really kind of outrage around the person who bought the rights. One of the smaller bands on the label, Delta Ray, decided to go indie and then started a Kickstarter to try to, I think it was a Kickstarter, some sort of, you know, platform to raise money to make their album. And Taylor tweeted it and her fans funded it immediately. So it's kind of this opposite, right, of the artist really corralling their fans into to a goal.
The mob can be used for good and evil. Basically. One last thing before we move on. One of the responses to Powers was she received a lot of criticism for not helping champion women or for denying Del Rey a genuine voice and so on. And there was a very interesting response from a journalist named Jessica Hopper on Twitter, who made the point that any kind of review, even a negative one, is a sign of respect and represents genuine engagement and is a preferable option to being ignored, which is what most of us endure in our work, right? And it brings up an interesting question, like, how hard can you be on somebody? Because I'm thinking about, remember when we talked about Amy Cuddy?
Yeah.
But I let's before you get into that, I mean, that actually is a point that you see in some of the sociology of criticism. So Sean Bauman made that argument about film, that simply the act of reviewing film with the conventions of artistic criticism rather than like Consumer Reports style criticism made people take film seriously as an art form, even if the particular work is reviewed negatively. And then Mahdi, Rajiv Mahdi, had a series of earlier articles on rock music, arguing that rock music criticism was one of the things that made people take rock music seriously as an art form.
But that doesn't help make the object of the criticism be seen as more serious, does it? Like, so Powers being critical of Del Rey's work might help pop music and pop music criticism, but it doesn't necessarily help Del Rey, does it?
Yeah, so in the hypothetical where we assume that Powers gave a pan rather than a rave that the artist didn't like for idiosyncratic reasons.
Right.
That would still validate the generic form of, you know, female singer-songwriters or something like that.
Yeah, and I also think that, you know, that tweet was also a way of driving more people to either buy her album or stream it, right? Yeah. And so, I mean, this is like a controversy that's not a controversy, right?
Yeah.
Right? That, you know, that I think in some ways are manufactured to, number one, to be able to display to people like Powers and the world, see, I'm powerful. See, look at my response. I mean, I don't believe if she didn't think she could activate her fan base in the way that she did, she wouldn't have done it. And so this was kind of like a display. And so I think that this was, you know, whatever. It was like Lana Del Rey flexing a little bit, right? And saying, look at me, look at what I can do, right? You know, it's like, you know, what did Lady Gaga call her followers back in the day?
little monsters.
Little monsters. It's like Gaga could like activate her monsters, right? To come to her defense whenever she wanted to. You know, Beyonce has the Beehive, right? I mean, like any popular artist, you know, worth their salt has a kind of fan base where, you know, they can send out a tweet and then, you know, whatever response will be swift. And so I think it sends out a signal. Number one, I can flex, right? And number two, hey, it's going to just drive up, you know, people listening to my new album.
You've been listening to The Annex, an academic sociology podcast. You can visit our show site at sociocast.org/annex. We are on Twitter at SocAnnex and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Our producer is Liseth Moreno. Music by Lena Orsa. I'm Joseph Cohen. Thank you for listening.